So he claims to be from the island of Formosa.
That's right. He's whiter than the average whitey. He's blonde. He said people lived mostly underground.
Why was he claiming to be Formosa?
Formosa Files is sponsored by the Frank C. Chen Cultural Foundation.
Welcome. Welcome to Formosa Files. I'm Eric Michael Smith.
I'm John Ross.
We thought today we would just jump right into one of the more fascinating stories that I've stumbled across via John here. And it has to do with a dude who shows up in the courts of Europe 300 some years ago.
Yes. So he arrived in London in 1703, claiming he was from Formosa.
Okay. So and this guy's he's white.
He's whiter than the average whitey. He's blonde.
Blonde and white. Okay.
Yes. Fair skin, even, you know, amongst his fellow Europeans.
So he claims to be from the island of Formosa.
That's right.
Okay. The first thing that comes to my mind here is this is, you said 1703. But Europeans had had contact at this point with Africans.
Yes.
For many hundreds of years with people from the Arabian area, with Asians, with Japanese, Chinese. How would they possibly have even for even a half a second have entertained the idea that this dude was a Formosan?
Okay. So the first thing obviously was his white appearance. At the time, they didn't know about genetics. Okay. So you could come up with an environmental explanation, as he did. He said people lived mostly underground, and they were went above ground, surrounded by trees. So they kept out of the sun.
Well, I mean, we do keep out of the sun here, but yeah, not quite to that extent. Okay, so he's arrived in, you said, London.
Yes.
And he's claiming to be a Formosan. What other evidence does he present to prove that he's Formosan?
Well, he has a Formosan language, which he's invented. He's written a little Bible with all his symbols, and he has a lot of information about Formosa.
Okay, so we got ahead of ourselves a little bit here. This guy's name was?
Salmanazar. George Salmanazar.
Salmanazar. And when I hear that name, I instantly think of the Bible.
Yes, he took the name from the Bible.
Was it his real name?
No, we don't know his real name. He wrote a memoir, which was published after his death. So he died in 1763, and his memoir was published, but it's frustrating. He doesn't give his name, and people have tried to track him down. They don't know. He was French, though they couldn't pick the regional accent. He was an absolute chameleon for languages. He was brilliant. I mean, that's what got him into trouble early on.
So why was he claiming to be Formosan?
Oh, well, it's a long story. You have this brilliant young kid in southern France, and he went to school. He's taught by Dominicans, and then he went to Jesuit school. Didn't like it. He was brilliant at learning Latin and Greek, but he dropped out, and he took to the road, and he pretended to be a pilgrim on his way to Rome.
Okay, so this was very popular back at that time. You would go to Rome and visit the various holy sites and whatever, and along the way, you would beg for alms or for donations.
Yes. So it didn't work out well, just being a Frenchman in France begging. So he switched to Irish, pretended to be from Ireland.
I guess that's a little further away, so it's a little more needy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's gone all the way from Ireland, and he's in France and needs help. That didn't work out that well. These are very, very difficult times in France and all of Europe, actually. This is peak Little Ice Age. It's about 1690s. Yeah, 1690s. That's the peak of the Little Ice Age. There's famine. You know, you've got more than a million people dying in the area from lack of food. So you have to be good to be getting donations.
I see.
So he had to up his game, and he changed from an Irish pilgrim to a Japanese one.
Okay. And this is without makeup. This is without any sort of prosthetics or anything. He just claimed to be Japanese.
That's right. So he comes up with his language, which will later be Formosan. But at the time, he's passing it off as Japanese.
So when you say language, you're talking about both a spoken and a written form of some sort of a language.
Yes. He wrote down some symbols, which he said was a language. And he's also saying things aloud, praying out loud.
So mumble jumble.
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So the Japanese angle isn't working out so well for him. He's not making quite as much money as he would like. So he swaps over to being a Formosan.
Well, no, actually, he gets a few jobs along the way. He's a waiter in a coffee house. He's joins two different armies. He travels around Europe a lot. His father had left the home when George Salmanazar, I was just about five. And one of his trips is to see his dad, see if he can get some money from him. So he's traveling around Europe, sometimes working, sometimes begging. Now, the change from a Japanese to Formosan was actually not his idea. His hoax as a Japanese pilgrim got busted by a chaplain of an English regiment in Holland, a chap called Alexander Innes. He realized it was nonsense, and he tricked Salmanazar. He got him to write down something, and then, oh, I've lost it. Can you write it down again? And then let's compare the two. Ah, okay. So
that's brilliant. So
yes.
So you claim to be this, write something for me. Oh, darn, I lost it. Could you write it again? And of course, they don't match, so busted.
Yes. Now, rather than expose him as a fraud, this Innes chap wanted to take it up a notch. He said, okay, Japan's a little bit too well known. Make it Formosa, publicly baptize you, make a big show of it, and we'll take you over to London.
So we have to remember the religious element and the religious strife of the times, the Catholic versus Protestant issue that was going on.
Yes.
So he claimed to be a former Catholic that had converted over to the true faith of Protestantism.
Well, he claimed to be from Formosa, that he was abducted by Jesuit priests.
Wow.
And then even though they threatened him with the tortures of the Inquisition, he refused and escaped.
So they abducted him in Formosa?
Yes.
Wow.
And then he escapes and meets up with this Anglican chaplain and realizes that the Church of England has the true word and converts. So that was his entry into London. He had this Anglican chaplain introducing him to people. And Salmanazar's main angle was the evils of Catholicism and the beauty of Anglicanism.
Which fit perfectly at that time for the situation in London.
Absolutely. It was only a few decades ago that there'd been a lot of strife, and they'd actually had a coup replacing the Catholic king with a Protestant one.
Okay, but I still have to go back to that first question that I have of, like, you've seen Africans, you've seen Asian people, you know about Japan, you know about China. These Europeans have some knowledge of the rest of the world, and yet he was able to get some people to buy his story.
Yes, it's incredible, isn't it?
But that kind of speaks to, if you want to look at like the larger narrative arc, it kind of speaks to how much was known about Formosa, or how little was known about Formosa right about that time. We're talking, what, 300 years ago here?
Yeah.
So he gets to London and he keeps up with his charade of being a Formosan. He tells stories about what it's like to be a Formosan, what the customs are. He describes he gives a whole like a list of the cities and other stuff.
Yes. So it all happened very quickly. He turns up and he's quite a celebrity. After a couple of months, he's showing people samples of Formosan writing. So well received that let's put out a book. So he puts this out in very short time. So 1704 publishes a description of Formosa. And he describes this wonderful place, gold and silver everywhere. Sort of civilized, people follow the laws, quite strict.
But live underground to stay away from the sun.
Yes. Eat snakes for breakfast.
Hmm.
Sacrifice children, and interesting modes of transport. Had sedan chairs carried by teams of elephants and camels and what have you.
So it seems like he's really picking and choosing a little bit, like he's grabbing a little bit of what he's heard about Japan, a little bit of India, a little bit of China. And then the only twist is that they happen to also be Caucasian.
Yes, yes. The pictures which accompany this 1704 book, yeah, they look like Caucasians. Crazy, crazy. Though if you compare it with some actual real pictures from the time, there was also a tendency to draw people as Europeans.
So he describes the government of the supposed Formosa. He describes the names of cities, which are names like
Bigno, Zernesta. I can't remember the capital city.
Just total fabrications that
do not sound anyway like Chinese or Aboriginal.
You know. Right.
So you mentioned what was known at the time. It's interesting because just before his book came out, he's working on it, there was a translation done of Dutch missionary to Taiwan. He'd been out here with the Dutch who were in the Tainan area from the 1620s to the early 1660s.
This would be the first Dutch missionary to Taiwan, the famous one.
Candidius, yeah.
George Candidius?
Yeah.
All right. So for people who may not be aware, he really did come to Taiwan.
Yes.
And he really did convert some locals, and they named a lake after him, and he became relatively well known in Europe afterwards.
Yes. So the translation of his account of Formosa came out just before Salmanazar's book.
Like literally?
Yes, yes.
Just before?
Just before. Just, it could be a matter of weeks.
So you would have been able to have side by side two books on Formosa.
Yeah.
And one of them is this total hogwash bit from Salmanazar, and the other one is from a Dutch missionary who actually has been to Taiwan or Formosa at the time. And how long had he stayed on the island?
He had two visits, probably a decade if you put it together.
A decade. A decade versus nonsense. Okay.
Yes. So what do you do when you're writing a fraud and then something comes out?
Yeah. What do you do?
He ignored it, but in the preface, he called him out and just said, you know, it's rubbish.
He challenged the missionary.
He challenged the missionary.
And ballsy guy.
Yes. He made fun of the lack of hierarchy. Candidius presented a very egalitarian society with not many rules.
But so he would have been mainly in contact with one Aboriginal group.
Saraya.
Okay. So he was describing what he understood to be the customs of the Saraya.
Yeah. Yes. He spoke some of the language.
No. Mm.
So Salmanazar calls him out on that. He says, for example, Candidius says there are no laws for adultery. Then he goes into and, you know, this and that. And the supporters of Salmanazar would pick up on a point which still today is a difficult one. Candidius said that the men lived apart from the women.
The Formosan men live apart from their women.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, which is not bad.
Okay, you're looking at it as not bad. I'm seeing it as a little lonely, but
okay. But the strange thing is that the women were not permitted to give birth until they were in their late 30s.
So this is the account from the Dutch missionary. No babies until your late 30s.
Forced abortions for pregnant women.
So that's a very salacious claim and also illogical.
Yes.
So what do we make of that?
Well, we haven't got an answer to it. Mm. People have suggested that it was just a temporary measure. Surely it couldn't be something that you could sustain for
right.
a long time.
Yeah.
The standard answer is that for some reason there was a very strong superstition that it was bad luck for men to go hunting while women were pregnant. Bad luck for men to be engaged in warfare when women were pregnant.
And they were in warfare a lot.
Yeah. So once men had finished with their fighting and headhunting activities, when they're ready to retire, so to speak, they could procreate.
But Candidius' account does give a couple of very truthful facts about Aboriginal life then and to a degree now as well.
Yes.
He talked about the fondness for brewing their own version of alcohol.
Yes, rice, wine. Mm.
And about certain religious practices,
mm-hmm.
How they prayed, and I guess there was some nudity involved in their prayer.
Yeah, there's a wonderful account of priestesses climbing up onto the top of the temple and stripping off. And
So I don't know if that still occurs, but there's certainly still the brewing of the rice mijo that is still. Yeah. And Salmanazar failed to mention any of those things.
Yes, he had them smoking pounds and pounds of tobacco, but not too keen on the drink.
Hmm.
Now the tobacco, of course, is an interesting one. That's from the New World.
That's right. So he's picking that up from the quote unquote Indians that Columbus quote unquote discovered, right?
Mm.
Okay. So Salmanazar, here we have an actual account of a guy who has been there. And he's still challenging it. And he's saying things like, oh, you were on one part of the island. I was on another part. Or I was over here. You were over there.
Yes, it's saying that the Dutch were in some very far-flung, remote area. So it'd be like describing England if you went to the Hebrides up in the Scottish Islands. Yes.
But not everyone is buying Psalmanazar's lines.
Absolutely. So he goes before the Royal Society, collection of the greatest scientists of the time, including Isaac Newton.
Who was writing like famous books at this time.
Yes, he actually put out a book, Optica, on the physics of light, the very same year that Psalmanazar put his book out. And he's the genius of his time and of all time, really.
So we don't know for sure, but Isaac Newton could have been in the same room as this Psalmanazar character.
Yes, he's likely up at the end of the table.
Wow. Just imagine, yeah.
Yes.
Although Isaac Newton also enjoyed some pretty weird tales himself. He thought he could turn base metals into gold, and he was also into like the end of the world and all of that based on the Bible.
Hugely so, yes. Later on, all these manuscripts came out. He was into alchemy and end of day stuff.
But we know for sure that there were two well-known people who were at this guy's trial, so to speak.
Yes, there was Edmund Halley.
Oh, of Halley's Comet.
That's right. He tried to catch out Psalmanazar with different questions about the sun and what have you. He's asking about when the sun is at its highest, you can see it shining on your, under the chimney, you've got your stove, you're boiling things. Right?
Okay, high noon.
Yeah, and that's to show that it's, you know, sort of subtropics. It's not coming from an angle, right?
Okay, gotcha.
He's trying to figure out the angle is correct for the time and place. Psalmanazar's answer is that they have crooked chimneys. So he's not giving anything away. He's, yeah, early 20s, so.
You mean Psalmanazar is in his early 20s?
He's in his early 20s.
That's really young to be fomenting this amount of forgery. It's well done.
Yes, he's probably 21 when he turned up. In his memoir, he says he added 3 years to his age on Alexander Innes' suggestion. It would sound a bit better. But yeah, I mean, he's very young, so you have to admire the courage.
So he made it through an inquiry with these noted scientists of their day, and he came out unscathed?
Well, yes. Well, we haven't mentioned there was a Jesuit father, Fontenay?
Fontenay.
Fontenay.
Uh-huh.
Fontenay. Now, he'd actually been in China. And he'd met fellow Jesuits who had been, fellow Catholics that had been to Formosa, Dominicans as well.
And again, Psalmanazar's explanation would have just been, oh, that was a different spot.
Yes.
I was down here. They were up there.
Yeah. So Psalmanazar didn't break. So he didn't really win people over, but he didn't lose his supporters. But things gradually unravel.
Yeah. It's a pretty audacious thing to keep going for any decent period of time.
Especially when you have his book translated into European languages and then, you know, more pushback. Also, when Innes, he left, he, for his reward for converting and bringing Psalmanazar over was a nice posting, and which was overseas. And Psalmanazar seems to lose it. He, to make up for the decline in people believing, to make up for declining sales, so to speak, he's going down market. He's putting on a good show. He's increasing his intake of raw meat.
he's upping the story to include that the Taiwanese or the Formosan people eat raw meat, or he eats raw meat.
Yes, both.
Both, okay. Well,
so we have to think that in those days, stories were mostly oral.
Right.
So the book is one thing, but if you can put on a good show and be a good storyteller, that's even more important, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he was obviously entertaining. He was a complete opium fiend.
Oh, that must have given him a certain inspiration.
So yes, he's drinking a lot as well, smoking enormous amounts of tobacco.
So we're talking here, if we like, you know, pull back and look at the broader historical view of this, we're kind of talking about how Taiwan or Formosa was first discovered by the outside world. Or how people from places that kept records, because we have to remember that, you know, Aboriginal history in Taiwan, of course, goes back, you know, tens of thousands of years, but they didn't write it down. So we don't have a lot of records of that. But this is really, how did the West come to meet Formosa, essentially?
So you had the Dutch in Formosa, and you've got other people, you've even got Englishmen from 1670 to 1683, perhaps, you know, a good dozen years, there was an English factory, a trading post in Tainan. Took over when the Dutch got kicked out by...
Most people don't think of the English having been here, except for like later on, yes, when you have the, yes, Kaohsiung, you know, the Takao consulate, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So yes, it was quite small, but 12 years, unsuccessful. They wanted to trade mostly with Japan. That didn't work out. Japan had expelled all the foreigners except for Dutch. The very first Europeans on Taiwan, the very first Europeans, 1582, a Portuguese ship sailing from Macau, which is next to Hong Kong.
Right. At that time, a trading post?
That's right. The Chinese didn't like foreigners going to China, but to the Portuguese, they were grateful for helping them put down some piracy, and they let them have this small area.
Didn't the Japanese also, they were okay with the Portuguese for a little while in Nagasaki?
Yes, yes.
The Portuguese seem to have gotten away with a bit more than other people.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So the Portuguese are sailing up to Japan.
Through the Taiwan Strait.
Through the Taiwan Strait. So there's a ship every year from Macau up to Japan. And this one gets blown onto rocks, northwestern Taiwan. We don't know where exactly it was, but they spend 2 months stuck on Taiwan.
So they were, these survivors were not treated to what became quite common in later years, a party coming down and removing their heads.
Aha. Well, that might have happened if they hadn't been so able and well-armed.
Ah.
So they made it to the shores. Their ship went down a little bit later. They salvaged some stuff.
Okay.
And this is a magnificent story, the shipbuilding skills. They built a smaller ship from the wreckage of the destroyed one.
Oh, this is a movie-like story. Yeah.
So there were 300 men, and I think there were just about 10 people lost from attacks by the Aborigines and drowning and what have you. So this is a remarkable effort. So they're there in summer for 2.5 months, rebuilding the boat.
Living off the land.
Living off the land. They had some supplies. They had firearms, which was useful. So they made it back to Macau. Incredible, isn't it?
So we have now gone through the story of 300 years ago, even though people had been to Taiwan, people had written about Taiwan, there had been actual people who stayed as long as a decade or more on the island. We had this guy, this blonde dude, claiming to be a Formosan. In the end, how does it turn out for our dear friend Salmanazar?
Okay, a life of poverty, because he was a writer. Sort of a low rent writer. So he lived to a good old age, early 80s, and he was praised by one of the great men of English letters. Samuel Johnson spoke very, very well of Salmanazar. They knew each other and would share a pint at the pub.
Why does that name ring some sort of bell for me?
Samuel Johnson wrote the definitive English language dictionary before Oxford did it. Yeah.
Any connection to, not Gulliver's Travels, but some other famous book?
Okay, so Jonathan Swift of Gulliver Travels, he wrote a short story, well, a satire on based on Salmanazar's cannibalism stories.
Oh, so you're saying that the famous one where he writes about how the Irish should feed their children to the rich, that...
Yes.
That was based on this crazy guy claiming to be a Formosan.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, there are a lot of wonderful little connections with the Salmanazar story. I mean, the printing house where his book was printed, was it called the Black Swan, I think? Formerly a pub, no doubt. Print at the back, bookstore at the front. Candidius's book was published there, the same bloody place. Next door, also a printing house. This was a street of bookstores and printers. Next door was Robinson Crusoe, The Adventures of Robinson Crusoe, the story of a man cast away on an island. So that was a literary sensation. That was the biggest book of the century and one of the biggest ever. So let me see. So Alexander Innes, in many ways the mastermind of taking George to a higher level. Fraud, he was disgraced. Now, he wasn't just plagiarizing sections off a book. He basically stole a book and presented it as his own. A book called A Modest Inquiry After Moral Virtue.
So he plagiarized a book about virtue.
Yes. Plus a few indiscretions at his parish, and then he was lost his job.
And Salmanazar, ended up confessing that he was lying, right?
Yes, but it never gave his real name.
Okay, well, I think that's a good place for us to break off.
Excellent.
So anyway, we got to let this go, folks. Thank you for joining us on this first one. You are welcome to send us questions or complaints or suggestions to formosafiles@gmail.com. So, we hope you'll join us again.
Okay, signing off. Time for a drink, or as the Saraya people used to do, worshipping the jar.
Wow. Yeah. We'll leave it right there. See you next time.